Mario Sunday Roast on Today FM with Mario Rosenstock.
Welcome back to Mario Sunday Roast. Now, I first met my next guest when he directed Aikino some years ago, and we had a great time doing that. He's an Irish playwright, screenwriter, director. In 1980, he was the writer in residence at the Abbey Theatre. He wrote the pilot episode of Fair City, would you believe, for his sins. He wrote and directed the film version of Borstal Boy, which was released in 2002. And I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Peter Sheridan.
Lovely to be here, Mario.
Yeah, and I love your voice. It's a cracking voice, isn't it, Peter? You really boom it out there.
Well, it's Dublin, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the North Wall. It's very distinctive.
Great. Listen, earlier on we were talking to Larissa Nolan about Brit bashing, and I know that this is something that has relevance for you as well. She was talking about how it's become kind of de rigueur now for people to cast aspersions on the British nation and, you know, a bit of Brit bashing going on in Ireland. What do you think?
I kind of grew up in a divided household on that one. The dad was very pro-English, loved the soccer, loved the horse racing, loved going to England on the holidays. We went to Blackpool almost every second year, and the ma hated them. So there was always a tension in the house. So the ma wasn't averse to, you know, putting a gun to the Brits' heads and pretending that she might pull it sometime.
Yeah. The trigger. And how many of you were in the house?
Well, we had 7 kids in the house, and then we had up to 8 lodgers at any one time.
Go away.
Yeah.
Lodgers.
Lodgers. I slept with 3 lodgers. Myself and Jim slept in a double bed, and we had 3 lodgers and 3 single beds. Mick O'Callaghan, who was a fella from Limerick, worked for the oil company. Paddy Connolly was a cavern man, worked on the building sites. And Paddy Sutton, whose song was, "Don't Fence Me In." So we had great crack with the lodgers in 44, several places growing up there. And the ma, of course, loved cooking and cleaning for them and doing all that stuff. She was like the matriarch of several places.
And was this normal? Was this common to take in lodgers? I mean, you had 7 children and 8 lodgers, so there might be 15 people, 16 people
in
the house.
It was pretty uncommon. There was a few bread and breakfast joints around about the place where people would do a bit bed and breakfast. But the lodgers, they became part of the family. And the ma couldn't say no. If a fella turned up at the door and he'd no bed for the night, my ma would take him in. And that meant I would lose my bed, so I might be sleeping under the snooker table in the front room on the mattress, and he would get my bed for the night. And that was the whole story of my life, was where am I sleeping tonight? Because I never had a bed. I never had a bedroom. It was a movable feast. So I moved from one place. In fact, I was writing a thing last night. My brother Jim's celebrating a big birthday coming up.
Is it a roundy birthday?
It's a roundy birthday, and it has a 7 in it. Anyway, I was recalling, we're doing a sort of a memory book for him, and I was recalling that in 1968, when Jim was 19 and I was 16, Jim was, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, the two of us in the double bed, the 3 lodgers, and Jim is breaking his heart laughing at something that he's reading in a book. And I'm just thinking, I have to go to school tomorrow in O'Connell Schools. I'm only in third year. Please stop reading out loud at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was Samuel Beckett he was reading. He had discovered Beckett. And he turned me onto it. I remember some of the stuff. One of the things he was reading was, "The Times literary supplement is admirably adapted to my purposes of a never-failing impermeability. Even farts make no impression on it. One day I counted them. 618 farts in 14 hours. After all, it's not excessive. Sure, it's not even 1 fart every 14 hours. Damn it, man, it's unbelievable. I hardly fart at all."
That's great.
And that's straight from Beckett. And Jim discovered Beckett at 19. Yeah. And then we used to read Waiting for Godot out loud to the lodgers. 2 o'clock in the morning, they'd be listening to me and Jim reading Waiting for Godot, and they loved the first half, the funny bits.
So how many people are in your house now?
Well, that was my childhood.
I know. How many people are in your house now?
In my house now, I have me and Sheila, and we have a few students who live with us.
Aha! I was wondering.
Yeah.
I was wondering, did you have a propensity to bring in like 100 totally. Spanish students into the house because you need to have more lodgers?
No, I definitely have a propensity.
The lodgers, Sheila.
I definitely have a propensity to have people around me. I'm a bit like the dad. I love nattering with the young ones and finding out about them.
Was it fun, Peter? Let's say you say, not knowing where I'm going to sleep tonight.
It was hysterical.
Oh, so you make it sound fun.
It was hysterical. It was hysterical. Like, the dad had a ready-made audience for all of his theories. My dad had theories about everything, politics, art, history. So he loved that. And the ma loved cooking. And the ma loved making the supper for them. Mm. And the supper was a loaf bread cut up, buttered, put in the centre of the table with a pot of jam and a knife beside it and cups of tea. And the ma would come in. And on one occasion, my father was wrestling with a lodger called Ringo Ryan, who was from Tuamhle Mhara in County Tipperary. And he had insulted Dublin, and my dad couldn't take that, so he stripped off down to his trousers, and he's wrestling with your man on the floor, and the ma's stepping over him saying, "Ah, dad, would you get up and have your supper, please?"
It sounds like a scene from My Left Foot.
Well, it is a scene from My Left Foot. Okay. My Left Foot is really a movie about our family, but we just supplanted the Christy Brown family story on top of that.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, actually, we'll come to that now then, because it's actually one of your clips that you've chosen today, and it's the scene from My Left Foot. What is the scene from My Left Foot that you've chosen?
The scene I've chosen is the scene where he writes on the ground as a young boy, played by O'Connor, that young O'Connor lad.
Now, just for everybody out there, Jim Sheridan, your brother, is the director of My Left Foot.
Yeah.
1987, I think it was.
It was 1988.
1988. Yeah. So go on, describe the scene.
So he on the ground, the kid, with a stick of chalk between the toes of his left foot, writes the word mother on the ground. And the father is absolutely flabbergasted, picks the kid up, puts him on his shoulder and marches down to the local pub. This is my son, Christy Brown, genius.
I remember it well.
Now, that could have been straight out of our house. That could have been, because in everything that Christy Brown wrote about his father, he wasn't a nice guy. He wasn't a nice character. But Jim and I had done a stage version of that story in 1981, and it didn't work. For all sorts of reasons, it didn't work. We lost money on it. I was still paying the bank loan back when Jim made the movie 5 years later. I mean, the ironies of all of this are just amazing. But what we learned was you can't have a really bad father in a story about a paraplegic in a wheelchair. Somehow you have to make that dad a kind of an okay guy.
And presumably the Americans wouldn't have bought it.
Exactly.
Anyway.
And that he became my father in effect in the movie.
And was that, so you were aware, both you and Jim would have been aware that Ray McAnally guy is our dad.
Completely aware. Yeah.
God, I remember the scene so well. Yeah. And it's such a sweet movie. Here's the scene.
Jesus. Jesus suffering Christ. He's a brown, all right. Christy's a brown. Halt!
Where are you going, Paddy?
Where do you think? This man deserves a jar. This is Christy Brown, my son, genius.
Oh, isn't that lovely? McAnally was something, wasn't he?
Absolutely. He died very shortly afterwards, of course.
Yeah.
He was dead, I think, within a year of that movie being made.
I particularly remember him in a thing called A Very British Coup, in which he played the Labour leader. At the time, it was a brilliant performance.
Oh, no, he was an absolutely fantastic actor. I mean, his Bull McCabe was probably never surpassed by anybody, even Harris.
And I enjoyed Harris's as well. Yeah. And what about the shooting of that movie? So you were, as you say there, how ironic, you were paying back the loan to the failed stage play of My Left Foot while your brother was shooting probably a fairly low budget version of My Left Foot. And what were you hearing from the set? What were you hearing from your brother? Were you hearing that this was going well? Or
the big talk was that Daniel Day-Lewis was Christy Brown when he was having his lunch.
Yeah.
That was the big talk everybody talked about. Daniel Day-Lewis eats his dinner like Christy Brown would. Now, what that does is it focuses everybody on what the story actually is that we're telling. So this guy stays in character. He eats his lunch. He drinks his tea through a straw, as Christy Brown did. And it kind of calms everybody, because everybody really, you know, you can get into all sorts of funny stuff about when you're making movies about, you know, cost and technicalities and, you know, we didn't get the light today and we didn't get, and suddenly all that stuff doesn't really matter when you've got a guy who's a paraplegic on the set, being a paraplegic 24 hours a day. It's like suddenly all those discussions stop and the focus is Daniel Day-Lewis becoming this character, living this character 24 hours a day, which is what Daniel Day-Lewis did.
And I guess as a crew and as a director and as fellow actors, we would all go, right, let's join in with him and become part of this project. But I have a question for you about that, just on the side, Peter. I mean, here would be my take on this. Now, you please get involved, but I mean, my take on this would be that Daniel Day-Lewis is a gifted, naturally brilliant actor with all the tools that all great actors have, and piercing intelligence, patience, reasonably well-read, a great voice, a wonderful look, a work ethic. And I would always go, is it really necessary to involve yourself in all this method stuff? Or could Daniel Day-Lewis have just as easily produced that performance and other performances using his sheer skill?
I completely understand it. As somebody who writes, you know, you sit down to write a book, you have to get inside the book and stay inside it for the 8, 9, 10 months that you're writing it. You really do. You have to become, it becomes part of your day. It's out of fear. We all go into things out of fear. You know, so you're an actor and you think, I'm going to be found out this time. They're going to discover I'm actually not as good as I think I am. So out of that fear, Daniel decides to do the one thing that he knows how to do, which is to go deep inside the core of the person and stay there. It's like being in a, it's like being under the table when you're a child and having the safety of being under the table with all the adult legs there. Now, so you know that the world is there, but you're in this little cocoon. So Daniel puts himself inside of a cocoon out of fear. It's not out of arrogance. It's out of fear. Mm. And out of that fear, he creates something remarkable. And that's what he needs to do in order to be what he is in every given film that he does.
And knowing what you might know or about him, do you think he'll ever act again? Or?
Yeah, I do actually. I think there'll be a comeback. I think it's the inevitable consequence of the work that he does, the world that he inhabits. You know?
He needs it.
Yeah, so I think there will be, but I don't know when that might be.
No.
But I think there will be. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Okay, we're going to move on to your comedy clip, Peter. Who have you chosen for your comedy clip, first of all?
Woody Allen.
Yeah.
Now, Woody Allen, from the first time I saw Woody Allen, I got him. I got him for very specific reasons. Woody Allen had glasses. I had glasses from the age of 14. I always thought they were the biggest turn off for girls you could ever imagine. But I had to wear my glasses all the time because I couldn't see. And Woody Allen had glasses. I immediately identified with him. The second thing was he was small. I was small. I always thought that girls would like tall guys. So I was always afraid of the tall girls. But I wanted to have the courage to be able to ask them out. And that was Woody Allen's situation. On top of that, he was Jewish. I was Catholic.
I thought you were going to say, I'm Jewish.
That'd be great, Jewish.
And I used to have a big mop, a red hair.
Jewish
Mario,
from the...
I'm Woody Allen.
Jewish from the North Wall.
Yeah.
Jewish from the North Wall. But I remember, I was probably about 14 or 15, there was a clip of Woody Allen on the BBC, and in the clip, you know, he holds up this silver watch, and he says to the audience, this watch is very important to me. It's a prized possession. My grandfather, on his deathbed, he sold me this watch.
Jesus Christ.
That's one of my favourite jokes of all time.
Jewish Central. Come here, and this clip, though.
This clip is from a great movie, one of the very early movies that I saw, Take the Money and Run. He walks into a bank. He's trying to rob the bank, and he hands over a note to the man behind the bank. And the man behind the bank looks at the note and looks at Woody Allen, and he says to Woody Allen, there is a gub pointing at you. Here we go.
I can't read this. What's this? Act natural?
No, it says, please put $50,000 into this bag and act natural.
It does say act natural.
So I'm pointing a gun at you.
That looks like gub. That doesn't look like gun.
No, it's gun.
No, that's gub. That's a B.
No, see, that's an N.
George, would you step over here a moment, please? What does this say?
Please put $50,000 into this bag and act natural. What's
act?
Act.
Does this look like gub or gun?
Gun. See? But what's app mean?
It's act, A-C-T, act natural. Please put $50,000 into this bag. Act natural. It's not...
Oh, I see. This is a holdup.
Yes.
May I see your gun? Well, you'll have to have this note initialed by one of our vice presidents before I can give you any money.
See, I'm in a rush.
What?
I'm in a rush.
I'm sorry, but that's our policy.
Terrific. That is a beautifully written scene. I'd love to have this note initialed.
He's a total genius.
Yeah.
Comically, comedically.
And
I mean, just those early, particularly those early films, Annie Hall, you know, just little simple things. Like he's walking down the street, there's a guy trying to park a car and he starts waving him into the space. Yeah. In such a way, a man crashes into the parked car and he just walks off.
Yeah. I like the one about I think it's Annie Hall, and they're discussing this critic. They're criticizing in a movie queue, and they're talking about this writer. And
Marshall McLuhan.
I'm Marshall McLuhan, and I think you're an idiot. I totally disagree with what you're saying. He just walks out of the queue. Fantastic. Okay, we're going to take a commercial break, Peter. Come back to us after the break, where I'm going to be talking to Peter about The Abbey, Sean O'Casey, Brendan Behan, and Sean Penn. Back after this.
Mario Sunday Roast on Today FM with Mario Rosenstock.
Welcome back to Mario's Sunday Roast, and I'm here with playwright, screenwriter and director Peter Sheridan. And Peter, we're going to talk about your hero in a minute. And I know it's difficult for people to choose a hero figure, but you've been very kind to do it. But we're going to go in a roundabout way, because you've been very associated with the works of Brendan Behan as well, and I know you have huge admiration for Brendan Behan. But through that, there's a great story about Sean Penn. Tell me all about this.
And there's a great connection of Sean Penn to Sean O'Casey, because Sean Penn was called after Sean O'Casey by his mother, whose name was Eileen Ryan from Tipperary.
Oh, wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, there you go.
Excellent.
Well, Sean and I had a project in the early 90s. We were trying to do a film on Brendan Behan, and Sean was scheduled to play it. And so part of the plan was that I would spend some time with him in America, and we would try and get offside somewhere where I'd be able to sort of fill him in on the history, you know, and that he could listen to my voice, because I wouldn't be that far away from Brendan in terms of how I speak and all that stuff. So the plan we came up with was the day after filming on Dead Man Walking finished. You remember that movie which Sean got nominated for? It's a film about a guy who gets executed by lethal injection.
Yeah.
And there's this nun who's sort of intervening on his behalf in the final days leading up to his execution. It's a powerful, powerful film. And the day after that film finished shooting, Sean and I got into a car to drive across America. That was the plan. We were just going to be in a car for 7 days, just talking about Brendan Behan and playing Brendan Behan tapes. So when we got into the car and we're driving out of Manhattan, heading up towards, we were going to head up through Ohio, I put on a tape, and it was Willie Nelson singing, "Baby, I couldn't love you."
Great stuff.
"Just as much as I should." And I looked across, and Sean Penn was streaming tears down his face. And he just said to me, "Peter, please take that off."
Yeah.
He was fighting with Robin Wright Penn, the mother of his children. They were having huge problems.
And that was ringing a bell with him.
And he was absolutely just blown away. So I took the tape off, turned it around, put it back in the slot and pressed play again. And what comes on? "Do you have to let it linger?" Dolores singing, "Do you have to let it linger?"
Yeah.
So, you know, we spent 7 days in the car together.
Playing awkward pieces of music.
Driving across the States. With Sean, you know, talking about all of the stuff, talking about, you know, his own family background, me telling him about mine. And his mum used to always ring and say, "I'm so glad you're with Peter, because I know Peter doesn't drink. That's wonderful, Sean. Wonderful you're with Peter. It's so good." So I used to do all the driving in the evening and then the nighttime, and he would do the morning, daytime driving.
Right.
And we drove across America, and we just stopped in odd places, and he would be treated like royalty because he was a movie star. Because that is royalty in America, is being from Hollywood and being a movie star.
And was there pretty much instant recognition
of the places, yeah. Mm. He would be recognised immediately. It was an amazing 7 days of my life. I actually wrote a thing about it, not for publication or anything, and I sent it to Sean, and he absolutely loved it. He just loved the thing I wrote about him, that 7 days in the car.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. And it wasn't for publication or anything?
No,
just a personal little letter?
I just wrote it. I just said, this is my recollection, my memory.
Yeah.
Of that trip.
And what about the putative project then?
Well, it fell apart really because Sean decided he couldn't come to Ireland.
Like nearly everything.
Yeah, that his children were too important. He didn't want to come to Ireland. And then he was afraid that, you know, Robin would move state with the kids and he'd never see them again. And there was all of that stuff going on. And he was just really, really sorry and really upset that he was upsetting us, because we had invested a lot of money in it. And we lost like a lot of money as a result of it. But I got to do a small version of Borstal Boy, which at least something positive came out of it. And I wrote a book. I wrote my first book as a result of the film collapsing. It was called 44, and that became a bestseller and changed my life. So you just never know what's around the corner in our business.
Yeah, brilliant. All right, and this gets in a roundabout way, as I said, of course, to your hero, who is Peter Casey. We said this in the meeting. Thank God it's not Peter Casey. It's, of course, Sean O'Casey.
Yeah, well, I grew up, I was born on Abercorn Road, number 12 Abercorn Road in East Wall, and Sean O'Casey had lived in number 18 for many, many years. But when I was growing up, the heroes in that area were boxers. That was the North Wall. It was really famous for boxers. So we had the likes of Spike McCormack, who'd been middleweight champion of the world. Spike's two sons, Pat and John McCormack from British Gardens, both British champions. John was European champion. Gus Farrell, one of the best amateur boxers ever grace a ring. Fred Teeth, Harry Perry, I was a member of British Railways Boxing Club. I fought Christy Elliott 3 times in the National Stadium. Christy went on to fight professionally in America. So I was involved in this world of boxing. And then at around age 13, 14, I started to hear the name of Sean O'Casey, from a lot of the old ones who lived in the area. I'd be delivering me newspapers. I had a little paper around. They'd be saying, that Sean O'Casey, I took him to court and I got money off him. See, he used my name in the play. You didn't know that now, did you?
Oh, yeah.
I'm Mrs. Henderson now in Juno and the Paco.
And you'd know Mrs. Henderson?
Oh, yeah. Loads of them got money off him. They actually I got 30 shillings off. Man, Mrs., your woman down the street, flute are good, he got 35 shillings off me. He lives in Ballybock.
That pox bottle, that Captain Boyle, he can feck off.
That flute are good, fella, now. That flute are good, fella. He wasn't at all like Mr. O'Casey portrayed him, let me tell you. But anyway, Sean O'Casey, and I just kept hearing these names. And then the stories about him, he would dress in a kilt on a Sunday morning, get his bagpipes out, and he would march from Abercorn Road across the bridge into Seville Place to the headquarters of the St. Lawrence O'Toole's Pipe Band, of which he was a founder member, 99 Seville Place. Now, the only thing was that he was a terrible pipe player. And people used to run when they saw him coming because he was an atrocious pipe player. But he loved the whole thing surrounding it. And of course, Sean O'Casey's first girlfriend came from Seville Place across the road from where I lived. Her name was Moira Keating. Moira lived right into the into the 1980s, and she was a great family. But Sean O'Casey then just was one of these figures. Like, somebody as famous as Sean O'Casey came from my area. And then I had to find out everything I could about him, which I did. Discovered the plays, and then my father put on the Sean O'Casey plays in the local hall, the Oriel Hall. Only I was to discover years later that Sean O'Casey put on plays in the Oriel Hall. Yeah. He was a member of a drama group that rehearsed in the Oriel Hall. Yeah. They stored guns in it during the War of Independence. And of course, he famously wrote the history of the Irish Citizens' Army under the name P.O. Cohasic. And he published it, self-published it, with money that he inherited after his mother died.
Okay.
He was a fascinating guy.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating man. And I've had an obsession about Sean O'Casey all of my life. And, of course, he moved to England in the late 20s and, never really came back to Ireland. But, what a wonderful writer. To think of a working-class guy like Sean O'Casey, who came from no-moneyed background, very poor. His father died when he was 4 or 5. You know, they lived in poverty. They moved house all the time. They lived in East Wall. He lived in Mountjoy Square. He lived in 422 North Circular Road, where he wrote the 3 plays, Shadow of a Gunman, Juno on the Paycock, and The Play on the Stars. The house is still there. The room is still very much as it was when Sean O'Casey wrote those plays. I mean, extraordinary stuff that's still out there for people.
Wow.
So O'Casey's been a hero of mine all of my life. And I once did a programme for RTE called Standing on a Giant's Shoulders, and he was the giant I was trying to stand on.
Oh, well, very eloquently put. And it's been brilliant talking to you today. Just a final thing. Any brief words about what's going on in the Abbey and stuff like that?
I say to people, it's not an easy situation to describe. It's complex. It's not simple. Mm. You can't sort of do it in a soundbite.
Yeah. So do it in a soundbite. So.
Well, when you're explaining, you're losing.
Yeah.
You know, look, basically two guys come from Scotland, and they have a completely different concept of what a national theatre is. And they go in there to do a completely different thing. A lot of it is completely at variance with what we would imagine the Abbey Theatre should be doing. For example, there's no literary department anymore. The idea that the Abbey doesn't have a literary department seems anathema to what the Abbey represents and means.
Yeah.
The idea that the Abbey would be employing wafts of people who are, not from here, that are, people who've come from London to be in a show, it just seems, what are we doing that for? What's that about? I mean, the Abbey has been the major employer of Irish talent since the foundation of the Abbey, since they first got a grant in the 1920s. And it just seems that these guys, the two new guys, are breaking all the rules. They've been very successful on many levels. They've reinvented the audience. The audience that go to the Abbey now are not like the audience that went there 10 or 15 years ago. It's a whole new thing, and they've been very successful at marketing the Abbey, at putting the Abbey up there. So they've done some really good things, but they've done things that just seem to run completely counter to what the Abbey Theatre is there for. And now there's conflict over the two directions in which the theatre is being pulled. And it's not easy to explain.
Okay.
But it's a situation that needs resolution and needs looking at.
All right, Peter Sheridan, thank you very much for joining me this week on Mario's Sunday Roast.
Every brand has a story. Some are built over decades, others over centuries. Discover the German car brand, meticulously engineered over 120 years to bring you our cleanest, most efficient engines yet. Discover Opel. Come and celebrate Opel's 120-year anniversary event at your local Opel dealership. Choose your perfect 191 Opel, then choose your preferred offer, like 0% PCP or HP finance, a guaranteed minimum of €3,000 scrappage, or 3 years free servicing. Opel's 120-year anniversary event. From now until January 31st. Visit your Opel dealership for more. Opel, the future is everyone's. Lending criteria, terms and conditions apply. Hire purchase agreement provided by Bank of Ireland Trading as Bank of Ireland Finance.
The big clearance event is now on at Currys PC World, with incredible deals across Ireland's largest range of home appliances and technology, plus free delivery on all large kitchen appliances. Get big savings of €500 on the De'Longhi bean-to-cup coffee machine, only €399. Save up to 40% off Canon cameras, and there's even up to €480 off large screen TVs, with better than half price on Samsung soundbars. Big clearance savings in store and online at Currys.ie. At Currys PC World, we help you get it right.
More businesses borrow from Bank of Ireland than any other lender. Because we understand the importance of time, you can now apply for a business loan in minutes and get a quick decision. When it's time for that loan your business needs, talk to Ireland's leading business lender, Bank of Ireland, in branch, by phone, or online. Ireland's leading lender, based on Central Bank report. Warning: if you do not meet the repayments on your credit facility agreement, your account will go into arrears. This may affect your credit rating, which may limit your ability to access credit in the future. Security, lending criteria, terms and conditions apply. Over 18s only. Bank of Ireland is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Hey.
Mario's Sunday Roast on Today FM with Mario Rosenstock.